30, double shields, and so on, solid polyethylene. And there are lots of people who want to use foam flex and low foam type cables and whatever for the flexible link, and quite often it eventually breathes water. The FM8 cable, which was considered the cat's meow of ITT cable way back in the early 70s, I used that on my 432 Yagi array, and when I brought that down 5 years later, my goodness, the decibels of loss of each one of those jumper cables, and there's about 17 of them, all had essentially tripled in dBs because of water absorption at the top of those cables in particular. Beautiful looking solid, let me drop the solid black polyethylene outer jacket mil-spec cable. You would never think that something like that up in the air would suck up water, and it did. And the water had slowly migrated itself through that foam, and at 432 the insertion loss went up fantastically. So that antenna was really climbing high in noise figure in a way that I didn't know about because the loss of the jumper cables between the 16 Yagis. Okay, I think we've answered all of the questions of the people who signed in. Let me double check to make sure I didn't skip anybody. Give me your call letters right now, K2LIW.
One last question. Give me an RG number that you would recommend back barrier. Is RG9 the same diameter as an RG8?
Now, RG9 is my favorite cable as a jumper around the rotator at the top of the tower. I am not convinced that RG9 is rated for direct burial. The only cable I would trust for direct burial is hardline. And the hardline is rated for direct burial. Any of the flexible cables with a braid on the outside, I worry. I'll admit that some of the more modern cables that have both braid and a so-called 100% foil, and the foil is not just a wrap, the foil is really a continuous aluminum tube, maybe they're okay. But the only thing I would trust for direct burial is, as I said, hardline, rated for direct burial, 70 ohm CATV hardline. But maybe I'm ultra conservative, so I don't have a great recommendation for you. Anyone listening to me, do they have a recommended cable that is possibly flexible, RG8 like diameter for an HF service that you believe is good for direct burial? Give me your call letters right now. K2LIW on the TechNet.
K2KEY.
Bell recognized. Anyone else?
Would you be 2HWW with a comment on this?
Okay, Howie also recognized that. Mel, first, go ahead, Mel.
You can pull it through a conduit. That's the best thing. And use aluminum conduit. You know, I've got cables buried, electric lines to go out to the garage and all. I had to replace. So the original pipe under there was galvanized, rotted away, lost the power to the garage. So I dug up and put in another aluminum pipe conduit, but I guess for coax, I guess if you put PVC pipe in, you come out, you know, with the PVC, you put the sections together and glue them up, and then put the coax through, I don't see how anything is ever going to get out of there. Over.
That's a good approach as long as you properly prepare the ends. I've seen people bury PVC pipe and run all kinds of wiring through it. And then the end of the PVC pipe has a right angle bend, comes straight up in the air, right alongside of, say, for instance, a utility pole, and no cap. Water just pours in there, which almost defeats the purpose, in my opinion. So how you prepare the ends, the PVC pipe itself, properly installed, is a beautiful weatherproof material. Howie, what would you do to directly bury cable? Go ahead, Howie.
I would go with LMR 500 or LMR 600, direct burial times cable. And if I wanted to go, I could either go with LDF 450 up at the site. I have LDF 450 and I have times cable. The only thing is you need to put those connectors on right. Some of those connectors I had put on by Perfecto paid for it. You want to do that right. So I would go with either times, LDF, Andrews cable, or RFS. LDF 450 if you want hardline, but if you want a little more flexible, I go with LMR 500 or 600. 500 is in between half inch and 7H, and LMR 600 is 7H cable. Go ahead, Dick.
Okay, those are some recommendations. direct burial cable. That's a pretty tough environment. And after 13 years of a flexible cable, my first suspicion is that your cable has changed. I wonder, one quick question, Rich, on a super dry day versus a rainy season, have you seen any correlation with the changes in tuning on right after a rain versus a long dry spell? N2EO, K2RIW?
No comment, Dick.
I hear John. Yeah, absolutely, Dick. The loading changes when the ground is wet versus when it's dry.
That's the water in the cable.
That's a strong clue. Go ahead, John.
We used to do a test on cables like that. If he can do it, you run about a kilowatt or a 1500 watt heater at the other end of the cable, leave it on for 24 hours, then go back and check your readings. You'll find a vast difference if that cable is defective, and then just replace it.
WW had a comment on cable loss, Dick.
Yeah, but John, you're talking about a air-filled cable, and you're blowing a heater. You're blowing hot air through the cable, and his is a foam-filled cable, I believe. I don't think he has the ability to blow air through it. So what do you mean by putting a heater at the far end? Over to you, John.
Dick, an electric heater as a load, and the current going through the cable, and leave it on for 24 hours, then go back and make his tests again.
Now, that's an approach. I know that when I've had water in some of my coax cables at the top of the tower, I would pour a kilowatt of RF energy through it, thinking I would boil out the water, and it did not work. It just made a white, pasty mess of dissimilar metals with the fluid acting as the electrolyte between the outer conductor and the center conductor, the dissimilar metals and the current flow and whatever. It didn't work in my particular case. Go ahead, Howie.
I was listening to Richie, how he mentioned when you want to measure return loss using an MFJ or any antenna analyzer, you know this, Dick, there's two ways to do it. Have a position unterminated, and you want a connector at the other end that's an open termination, a real open termination, and a short. And you should get the same return loss with either a short or an open at that frequency. And that way your instrument will tell you what your return loss is.
Agreed.
Get to a load.
Yep, understand. And so into the dummy load, you confirm that the connectors are well installed with a known high reflectivity at the far end, short or open. And when you're below 1,000 megacycles, short or open works very well. Above, like at frequencies like 10 gigahertz, you're almost forced into using a short because now the little center conductor sticking out of there is almost an antenna and it radiates very well. So when you've got a known high reflectivity at the far end of the cable, that means the signal has to go down there, bounce, and come back. And whatever dB loss you measure, you divide by 2, and that's the loss of the cable, and it's a very good test. Not perfect. The perfect test is to put a known number of watts at the input end and measure how many watts come out of the far end into a good dummy load. That's the perfect test, because now you're measuring true transmissivity. The reflection test that I just described has a failure mode. If, for instance, there was a straight pin in the middle of the cable giving you a great big reflection at half the length of the cable, you would measure a very low insertion loss and you'd be happy. But when you when you did a real insertion loss on that particular case, you would find out right away that something is wrong. So a reflection test, you have to know that if something's wrong in the middle, it could give you a false positive. Anyone else that we've skipped tonight, give me a call that is right now, K2RIW in the TechNet.
The comment on this, Dick?
Go ahead.
If you use a sightmaster, a sightmaster will allow you to look along the thing and see if there's an impedance bump. What's good about a sightmaster, it's almost like a TDR, but it's a frequency domain, so you can look and see where the problem is, and if you have a pin, you'll see an impedance bump. It'll tell you exactly how many meters from the termination, from where you're generating it from the sightmaster all the way down, and you can actually see where the connectors are.
What Howie just called a sightmaster really is a TDR function, time domain reflectometry. And there's at least two different ways of making a time domain reflectometer. I think it was Glenn was telling us that the by taking a good square wave generator and putting impulses down a cable with the right kind of an oscilloscope monitoring what's going on. A smart guy can interpret that as a poor man's time domain reflectometer and measure the amount of time delay down to the reflecting device and back and figure out how many feet away it is. The Steinhelt this guy named Steinhelfer, way back in, I think it was 1968, wrote a series of articles in IEEE proceedings where if you sweep the frequency from a network analyzer into your unknown cable and measure amplitude and phase as a function of frequency, and you get a great big data set, and you put that particular data set into the right algorithm, it gives you a better time domain reflectometer. In other words, you can simulate the rise time of picoseconds when you do that, whereas making a real picosecond rise time, TDR, is kind of difficult. So the SiteMaster, I think, is using the Steinhelfer technique, the frequency sweeping technique. Okay, let's go over to John's deeper question, KC2WGB, K2RIW. Go right ahead, John.
Dick, I haven't posed a question yet. Which question were you speaking about?
You guys always have questions. If you don't have one, then I'll ask, then I'm going to make some comments about the emails that went back and forth this
week. We had.
Go ahead, Wesley.
Well, John has a set of questions that he put in paper, and he asked again. Also, I have sent you questions so you can easily read that in your email. And apart from the bunch of the material, but just the questions, and it's a specific set of questions. So I would appreciate if John reads his question, then you compare with whatever you got in the email.
Oh, I didn't know you were referring to that list. Okay.
Yeah. One of the questions that, rather deep questions that Wesley is asking us is that with reference to a magnetic field, does it have a standing wave? Does it have a stationary wave, traveling wave, mixture? None of the above. Is it affected by gravity? Does it create an E field? Does it require electrons and so on? We're getting into some rather deep stuff here. But a good set of questions when it comes to understanding at the molecular level. Also, Glenn mailed me a very nice report on what's happening at the molecular level. And I now realize after reading Glenn's report, let me drop, that there are more metals, there are more methods by which a complex molecule, in other words, we put a number of atoms together and you make a molecule, like water or formaldehyde or whatever. There are a number of ways that the individual atoms of a molecule can shake, rattle, and roll with reference to each other. And that does give you some additional kinetic energy. But when it comes to free air, and my definition of air is O2, N2, and H2, you know, the stuff that's in the room with you right now, it is my belief that since it's well documented on a number of references that those air molecules do have a translational speed of 500 meters per second on average, that I'm saying that 90-some-odd% of the kinetic energy of air molecules is due to their speed of motion. And that's what a thermometer measures. You think a thermometer is measuring how hot or cold something is. Hot or cold really means what is the average kinetic energy, energy of motion, of the molecules of the thing that you're measuring. In the case of a gas, those gas molecules are really moving lickety-split. And so Glenn did mail me this nice report on the various modes. And by the way, beautiful report. Would you believe there is a glaring error in one spot in that report? And that's where the report gives you the picture of a transverse electromagnetic wave in free space. Did you catch that one, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Dick, unfortunately, I haven't been catching much these last 2 weeks or so. So you better straighten me out. But it's kind of funny. It's just going back even on this, from the original discussion, which was where the molecules actually, inside air, was the nuclei actually moving back and forth. And I think originally I didn't quite follow that. And obviously, since that time, I think I've kind of expressed to you that I've completely changed my mind on that one, that it is moving, and that there's so much more moving going on at that time that, you know, certainly velocity is an absolute thing there. But, no, Dick, I didn't catch that one. I'm going to pass it back to you. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, I'm doing for a moment. Dick, there is on the email that I have sent you, right before the questions, there is a 30 seconds YouTube video that is showing stationary wave. I'm not talking about the stating wave, not talking about traveling wave. I'm talking about stationary wave. And it's extremely amazing. So you can talk to us, and at the same time you can view it. There is no audio on it.
Okay, I think you mailed me a total of four emails. One of them was a beautiful explanation of magnetic resonance imaging, or nuclear magnetic resonance, and the theory of its operation.
That was the before one. You see the icon of the YouTube, which actually is horizontal line, the button in it, and something like a paper clip. This one, it's 30 seconds only.
Okay, I see a total of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 emails from you, all on February 6th. Which one of the five, if you happen to know, which 5 p.m., 5:39, 5:36, 5:59, 6:01?
February 11th, at 11:50 p.m. It's right above the questions of mine. I believe you get it.
Okay, I've got a whole lot of emails from you on February 6th. I'm looking now for...
February 10th.
You believe you sent them on February 11th. Stand by.
Just a moment. Hold on. No, I'm sorry. That's February 10th. This one actually made me and John, and I sent it to Glenn as well. So Glenn has it as well. This one was absolutely marvelous, because we were looking from the perspective of no transfer energy because of the stationary wave just bouncing up and down. Then we were thinking with John, what would happen if... we put the Gauss meter is reading, so if Gauss meter is reading, is observing part of the energy of stationary wave, standing wave. So it is energy transfer, even though it is not supposed to be. And then we came to the stationary wave. It is beautifully explained in the Wikipedia. I have sent you the link for it. But actually, this particular 30 seconds video gives all of the properties of stationary wave, where you have actually traveling wave in there.
I'm looking at that animation right now called traveling wave equals sum of stationary modes. Is that the one you're referring to?
Yes, that's the one. That's the one. And you see all of the components in it, and then you see how it grows up, and you see the traveling wave in it. And John has a set of questions that we were working for, and we sent it to Glenn and to you, and I believe to Eric as well, but I don't remember that. John, can you pick up and make your questions?
WGB. Well, we were looking to define the magnetic field first. That's where our conversation started with. Is it a field? Is it a wave? If it's a wave, is it a standing wave, a stationary wave? And also, to go on with that, if the magnet was in motion, say a bar magnet just moving up and down, does the field create a magnetic wave? And if it does, could that wave be applied, like all other frequencies, to the double slit experiment?
Yeah, Don, good question.
And also, if the is the magnetic field represented by photons. Of course, I stand in it. Some of the questions are unbelievably stupid. It's not stupid at all. So I'm going to start it this way. Okay, so if the magnetic wave is represented by something, is that standing wave, stationary wave, traveling wave, mixture of everything or none of the above? Done. Then does magnetic field have a mass? And is the magnetic field represented by propagation of electrons? Is magnetic field represented by propagation of photons? And then, if it's photons, then photons do not bend. Then, the photon does not have a mass, it's a pure energy. So when the photon hits the particle containing the mass, air, then it becomes traveling wave. So the question was actually, do we have something, does the photon goes in a straight line, or does is spherical, that means it creates kind of wave like you see on the water. Then, is the magnetic, when you see the iron filing creating lines around the magnet, is that because of the photon propagated from the magnet that hits the mass? So, these kind of questions, some of them, sound absolutely out of sense. But there is a big sense in the subject. And to Xia.
Go ahead, John.
I just wanted to state that the wave on water is a slice of the plane. That's not spherical. I'm sure you know that, but I didn't know if Wesley was, which one he was expressing.
Okay. I believe that photons do get bent. I've known them a couple of times. I mean, you can bend them with a light pipe, you know, with a fiber optics. Call that dielectric bending if you like. I know also that a electromagnetic light wave from a far galaxy does definitely experience gravity lensing. On top of that, the first confirmation of the Einstein theory was that the orbit of Mercury, the apparent orbit of Mercury, the light coming from the planet was being deflected by the sun, and the timing was changing in a predictable manner. So photons in a electromagnetic wave do experience gravity lensing. That suggests to me that they've got a very small amount of mass. They're not thoroughly massless. For all I know, 99.99% of the energy of a photon is massless. But I think there is some mass there, because it is my best guess that only things that are affected by gravity, the things that are affected by gravity, have some amount of mass to them. But now, is a magnetic field, and by the way, let me drop for a second because we've got a problem here. With a good neodymium magnet, particularly like the kind that you've received recently, I hear tell that, what was it, WB2IKT, was it George, or was it... I think it was IKT who told me that you Wesley, came over to his house to get one of these very strong magnets. He gave you lots of warning about these neodymium magnets, how much damage they can do to your finger if you're not careful. These kind of magnets can put out a steady-state magnetic field, a non-changing magnetic field. In other words, in theory, I could make the measurement today, I could make the measurement an hour from now, a week from now, and I'm going to get something extremely similar in magnetic field. To my knowledge, that is not an electromagnetic wave. A transverse electromagnetic wave must continuously be changing at the carrier rate. So now the next question is, what is a magnetic field?
Is it electrons, photons, or whatever it is, does have a mass, doesn't have a mass?
KC2RFN.
Go ahead, Alan.
Good evening, Dick. You had said something before that is it's incorrect. And I don't know how it plays into the deeper levels that you're going here, but it is a glaring error. The light isn't actually bending when it gets encounters a gravitational field. The time space around the light is actually warping. The light itself is still actually straight. If you look at a light ray passing, say, a star, yeah, it appears to bend. but there's something called the theory of equivalence, that if you were on a spaceship and you were to shine the light across from one side of the room to the other, and then the ship accelerates, it'll appear that the light bends because it's going to hit the wall at a lower point. But that's not really what's happening. Obviously, the beam of light is always straight. It's just that in an acceleration field or in a gravitational field, it will appear to bend. But the photons aren't bending. They are still going straight. Do you follow?
Comment?
Yeah, I've heard that, and that's an interesting way of looking at it. If that's true, then how could you ever recognize the difference between, what we're going to call it now, gravity lensing? No, we can't call it gravity. Yeah, they call it gravity lensing. We call it the gravity lensing effect. What you're saying, the space-time has been shifted by the local massive object, and the light wave itself is not bending.
John has correlating questions.
Yeah, go ahead, John.
Dick, let's not forget, we don't have the photon or see it until it actually strikes something, which is what Glenn pointed out a few weeks ago. We are dealing with just the wave until it actually appears on the surface or strikes something.
But I can have a wave going down a coax cable, and yes, I haven't tapped into it, I haven't changed it in any way, and I sense it by putting it into a detector, but there's still a real wave in the middle of that coax cable.
Yeah, but it's with the mass. It's the string of electrons, not a photon.
No, but when you observe the wave, you lose the photon. When you observe the photon, you lose the wave.
Okay. Einstein got his Nobel Prize because of the photoelectric effect. When those photons went into that photoelectric tube, struck that cathode surface, and released electrons, the fact that the photon did that is a possible interpretation of it having mass. Although it's a bundle of energy, the bundle of energy was exciting those electrons around those molecules of that cathode material and released some of them. There are people who think that that represents a demonstration of mass. What do you think about that one, Alan?
I'm sorry, Dick, I got a phone call.
Okay, John, you got an opinion on that one?
I'm thinking of that one. I'm still back at the gravitational lensing. I know you are right, but I'm not sure Alan's right with that. The wave is riding in that grid plane or the geodesic around the planet. It thinks it's still traveling in a straight line, but obviously it isn't because we're able to detect it when it should be occulted by the planet. So that's a tough one to swallow.
NWS2N.
Yeah, we forgot you've got a space report, and you might even have a comment on this one, too. Go ahead, Paul.
Okay. While everybody was going to think about it, I was going to throw in the space report. But, oh, yeah, okay, yeah. Well, I agree. You're just viewing space bending. When Einstein had that, back in 1910, they viewed the eclipse and they noticed the star was offset a little bit from where it should be. They said, okay, there you go. The light is being bent. But what's happening is you're really viewing warped space. I'll give you a space report whenever you want, though, Dick. Thank you.
Good time now, Dick.
Okay, John thinks it's a good time now. Go right ahead, Paul. And what's NASA doing now? And last week they gave us 1,235 brand new planets. How can they top that one? Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, you're not going to top it. The Kepler Space Telescope is going to continue on. Data is going to be coming in for what, another year and a half, at least, I guess, on that. You're not going to top that for planet research for a long time, unless they put another one of those up there and look at a different patch of sky. There is another telescope coming up in about a year. We'll talk about that in a second. I just want to review the manned space program. It's still underway. STS-133 on the 24th of this month will go up. That's been delayed many, many months due to leaks around the external tank that have really stopped that from taking off. They took the whole thing back to the vehicle assembly building and worked on it, fixed it out of the launch pad now, and they're going to run some testing on that. I understood that went okay, so the 24th will be the next launch. Let me drop it. Two scheduled launches after that, and they're still talking Congress among some of the congressmen that they would like to continue it on. They don't have an American way of resupplying the space station. The commercial version is still a couple of years off, I think, at least a year and a half maybe away. You do have an ATV vehicle going up by the European Space Agency this week. That carries about three times the amount of supplies that a Progress shipped by Russia. So we do have a resupply capability. It's just not ours. So that's so much for the space station. Just want to quickly talk about the new telescope that's coming up. Let me drop it. WS2N. The one I'm talking about is called NuSTAR, NUSTAR, and that was originally scheduled to go up in August of this year, but rescheduled for 1 year from this month, next February. So we'll look forward to this thing. It's called the NuSTAR Nuclear Spectroscopic Telescope Array. Forward for that. That's a little bit different than what we've seen lately. It receives X-rays. They'll be looking for massive black holes in the universe with maybe billions of masses of our sun at the center of them, including other phenomena such as supernovas. They want to look at the elements that are being formed and figure out, what elements are being formed and what percentage. After all, that's how we all get started here. Everything that we look at and breathe here on Earth is caused from some supernova somewhere, maybe outside of hydrogen. Everything is being formed from that. So this NuSTAR telescope will be looking at that. It's a little different. It's going to be it's not going to be launched from California or even Florida, but out in the islands in some place called Kwajalein Atoll. Let me drop it. Takes off in an airplane. A jet-powered airplane and goes up about 8 miles and then launches on a Pegasus. They call it a Pegasus rocket. I mean, this thing looks like a big cruise missile. A cruise missile. It's got wings and all, and maybe about a meter in diameter, which puts the spacecraft itself around that same diameter, around a meter in diameter. And this telescope is interesting. It's got the mirrors, and the mirrors consist of like over 100, I think 130 or so of these mirrors that are put together, similar to like Dixie cups. If you were to take a pack of Dixie cups and keep putting one inside the other, and then open up the bottom, that's what it would look like. You have X-rays instead of light rays. X-rays don't really use like a parabolic mirror, like a regular telescope, like the Hubble. But they come down and they hit it glancing glows. Let me drop it. And the glancing glows, will be going through these 100 or 100 or so very, very polished mirrors again, not shaped parabolically, but more like a Dixie cup, and one inside the other. And as they hit it, they go as a glancing blow, and then they go behind it. Well, you would need maybe a 100-foot telescope to have a detector at the end. So what they do is, if you look at this thing, it's got this truss, this truss assembly that extends from one end to the other. I mean, if you look at this thing in the distance, it kind of looks like a spacecraft from the movie 2001, you know. the Discovery, it's got a front end and a back end, and there's this gigantic truss in the middle. And at one end is the mirror, and then at the other end of this 100-foot truss is this detector. Let me drop it. So it goes up, together, but then it extends in space. So now you've got this big difference between one end of the spacecraft and the other. These X-rays are going to be hitting it at a glancing blow and then going over to the detector some 30 meters away. So that's really the focal length is like 30 meters. And that's how it's going to do it. It'll be it's really an advanced type of Chandra space telescope that's up there for many years now. Probably 100 times more sensitive than that. And that's what they're going to be putting up. So I'll be looking forward to the new, they call it the New Star Space Telescope, a year from now, Dick. Roughly a two-year mission.
Question, Dick?
And, maybe about 500 kilometers up. And really an equatorial orbit. Back to you. WS2N.
John recognized the Chandra and now the New Star both using this kind of X-ray focusing technique, which you're right, is a glancing blow. If you put up an ordinary magnifying glass and you expect to focus X-rays, they just simply penetrate the glass like it's a piece of tissue paper. They don't get focused at all. But if you know, you'll notice that whenever you look at a storefront window at a very shallow angle, it becomes almost a perfect mirror. And by the same token, when you make the right kind of mirror-like materials so that the X-rays strike these multiple concentric tubular things at a glancing angle, at a very shallow angle, you do get focusing, and the actual material itself is bent into an extremely shallow hyperbolic curve. And then by holding it, I think it's at 30 meters out from the lens effect to the detector, you get a very high-resolution X-ray telescope. Fantastic piece of hardware. Go ahead with your question, John. K2LIW.
You must have anticipated my question. You answered it, Dick. Thank you.
Yeah, X-rays and cosmic rays, you got to do some very fancy things to focus those. Sounds like fun, Paul. You probably have heard that everybody's talking about a balanced budget, and therefore NASA is going to be cut back some more. I think NASA has already experienced a number of cutbacks over the last few years. You may know about that, Paul. And have you heard any words about further cutback that's going to take place and slow down some of these projects? WS2N, K2LIW.
Well, there's always been a movement, a group of people that are always trying to cut the NASA budget, which is, I think it's only like $3 or $4 billion per year, and that keeps getting cut, which is really, nothing compared to what it used to be. Back in, Apollo days, Gemini and Mercury days, people used to pay probably 10, 15 times that amount, adjusted for inflation. So we're way down in the amount of money that's being supported. But yeah, they keep cutting it. And yet there's a movement, there's always a movement to go the other way. You've got Senator Nelson used to be a congressman for many years. When he was a congressman, he went on the space shuttle. He flew at. He is now a qualified astronaut. You get guys like that. Senator Gahn from Utah. He was a senator at that time. These guys were all big proponents of the space program. And there's a lot of people like that. Probably another 50% or close to it that's against it. We drop it. It's against it, but not willing to pay that much more money for all these different advances. You got to remember that to cut any kind of a budget, that would be the last place I would go to, because it's been proven that any investment into NASA or any kind of science funding is, I think it's for every dollar that goes in, it's $6 more that's produced hundreds of thousands of jobs throughout all the different states. Huge buildings that have to be built, and scientists that have to be hired, and engineers and technicians supporting our infrastructure around that. It's a big loss when they cut the anything to do with the space program, especially with NASA. Back to you, Ed.
You gave a rough estimate that NASA is $3.5 billion per year, and we've got 300 million residents of the United States. That calculates to be $10 per resident. If NASA costs me $10, I think I'm very much getting my money's worth. To me, it's worth it, but I know that not everyone will agree with that. Getting back to what is an electromagnetic, what is a magnetic wave? That's a tough one. An electromagnetic wave, it is my belief, it is a changing magnetic field, and the rate of the change of the magnetic field creates an E field without electrons. Yes, there are photons moving from the moon to the Earth when I was listening to the Apollo 15 and Apollo 16 astronauts, and they were transmitting a signal at 2287.5 megacycles, and with that homebrew 12-foot dish that you can see in the August 1972 issue of QST magazine. August was the article called Houston, This is Apollo, and there you see the antenna I used to listen to those photons coming from a 10-watt transmitter on the lunar surface. And I know for a fact that not one single electron, I'm reasonably sure, not one electron left that antenna or went through space, just the photons of that electromagnetic wave. So as long as the magnetic field is changing at the rate of the RF carrier, it gives you the effect of a changing magnetic field. It gives you the effect of a changing electrostatic field, where under normal circumstances, I can only make a steady state electrostatic field by using an increase of electrons on one plate and a decrease of electrons on the other plate. That'll generate an electrostatic, a steady state electrostatic field. But you don't need electrons to make a changing magnetic field. So I think we've got a...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
So we've got to separate a traveling magnetic wave, a traveling electromagnetic wave, from a steady state magnetic field or a steady state electric field. And the so-called standing waves that are in that YouTube visual that you sent us, Wesley, you may call it a stationary wave. And by the way, I'm not quite sure if there's a real difference between a standing wave and a stationary wave.
I think John has more info about this.
KC2QIQ with a comment?
Yeah, but if it's a real wave, Glenn recognized, if it's a real wave, it's got to be moving. And to my knowledge, everything that you call a standing wave is really a forward propagating wave and a reverse propagating wave. And with your non-directional sensing device, like the probe on a slotted line, if you're using a non-probing device and you can see the forward-going wave and the reverse-going wave, you think you're seeing a wave that is not moving and going up and down. But if you use a directional detector, and there are people who have done that, you put a directional detector on a slotted line and slide it up and down, you no longer see the peaks and valleys of the so-called standing wave. We're going to go over to Glenn and then John in that order. Go ahead, Glenn.
Just a couple of quick comments, Dick. One was that on the, what is a photon? We throw this word around a lot. And does the photon have mass? Absolutely it does. It's definitely an elementary particle with energy. So in other words, when in the quantum model, quantized or quantum mechanics, when we take an element and we quantize energy with it, that's an element of a photon. So mass is definitely involved when we're talking about photons. Photons, you need an atomic model. It has to be. Because now you're effectively adding energy and mass together so in order to be quantized. So basically when we're talking about photons, you're assuming that you have an element, a the principal element of matter, and energy associated with it. Let me let it drop for a second.
How are you so sure that a photon has mass? You said it as if you're speaking ex cathedra, like you're speaking for the Pope and he's speaking for the deity. What makes you so sure that a photon has mass? If I asked you to prove it, what would you do, Glenn? Go ahead.
Well, if you saw that little article blip that I wrote a week or so ago, that was basically talking about the quantum mechanics or basically the buildup of the atom. In other words, how is the atom built up? But the one thing that's not included, which would be like part two to that, would be the energy interreaction. What happens when energy interreacts with the quantum model or the chemical model? You know, now we're starting to get into chemistry, but now add energy. When you add energy, now what we have to, when at the molecular level, we start talking about the quantization or making quanta of the particles. So that you have protons with equal number of electrons, and the neutrons could be imbalanced, or you could have isotopes and imbalanced ones. But when you're applying the energy and you're building the model, once that energy is quantized with the particle, that mixture of energy and mass is defined as proton. KC2, QIQ. Photon.
If I had a fluid like air, for instance, and if I want to add energy to that air, there's multiple ways I can do it. I can do it in a thermal manner. I can raise the temperature, which is really raising the velocity, the average kinetic energy velocity or speed of the molecule. That's the main reason it's doing it. In theory, I could also do a pumping action like you do with a laser if I have the right wavelength of electromagnetic energy, where the individual atoms are resonant at that wavelength. That little bundle of energy at the right wavelength will allow me to take those electrons and accelerate them to increase their energy by putting them in a higher orbit. And they're probably not going to stay there very long. They're going to jump back down and give off a very specific amount of wavelength of energy when they do that, specific magnitude and a specific wavelength. So there's at least two different ways that I can add energy to a fluid medium. And until you do it with resonant wavelength energy going into your medium, the medium might ignore it. You can have greater or lesser energy of the wave that you're putting into the medium, and those individual atoms, which are looking for a very specific wavelength, I think will ignore it. I wonder if you agree with that one, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LIW?
I do, except with one thing that, when you're talking about how you're adding or subtracting energy. But let's say if you wanted to just look at an element, any one element, whatever it is at the atomic level, and you want to know how much energy is associated with that element, you could build a quantum model and determine that amount of energy, regardless of air, temperature, any mass whatsoever. And you can break down that quantum model and look at it, and you can count its electrons, protons, neutrons, and determine the amount of energy with it, and it becomes called quanta. And then the smallest element of that is photon, or the amount of energy related directly to that atom. KC2, QIQ.
Although it's a little bit off to one side, let me show you some thinking that I had in the last week or so that may help a little bit. With my high voltage machinery, I've drawn some arcs. And what really are those arcs? We know that if I take ordinary air at standard temperature and pressure, the air that's in the room that you right now, and if I got two probes into that air, and if I put enough voltage on those two probes so that across them there is 30,000 volts per centimeter, I will get air breakdown. what is that air breakdown? This is my thinking of what it is. I've created the 30,000 volts per centimeter of local E field. In general, nothing happens. All of a sudden, a cosmic ray comes along, hits one of those air molecules, breaks an electron away from the nucleus. Once I have a free electron, I've now got the beginning of a plasma. That free electron in a strong electrostatic field gets highly attracted toward the positive terminal. The rest of the atom gets attracted toward the negative terminal, but he's much more massive. He doesn't move very much. Let me drop. And as I sent to you in that email, since we know from a whole lot of references that the mean free path of air molecules in a room, standard conditions, is 63 nanometers, when I've got a E field of 30,000 volts per centimeter, air molecules starting off at 500 meters per second of velocity, and now an electron has been broken away, and in that E field he gets a chance to move 63 nanometers before he strikes another air molecule. Because of that E field, the electron volts he builds up allows his velocity to go, I forget what the exact number was, but I think it's 20,000 meters per second. And I think that's the threshold number. When that electron is moving 20,000 meters per second, he doesn't bounce off the next air molecule's electrostatic charge of its electrons going around that outer layer. He now gets a chance to penetrate. He gets a chance to impact ionization. He really penetrates that molecule. He does it with enough velocity that he breaks off more electrons of that new air molecule he struck, and he's now starting the avalanche process. And when that avalanche process really builds up, you and I call it an electric arc. If I just took air and heated it, let me drop. All I'm doing is speeding up the average speed of the air molecules. But if I make the air hot enough, all of a sudden, it's again, those air molecules are moving at something like 20,000 meters per second. They have the ability, when they strike each other now, to create impact ionization and create a plasma. So if I put enough temperature into air, I can create a plasma. I can do it a lot easier with a high voltage field, but in either case, it takes real velocity. And this is what's going on with the particle accelerator. You're moving things fast enough that you're penetrating that outer cloud and really starting to break up what's going on inside and starting to make ionization. You're starting to release particles that you can start putting into detectors and trying to figure out what's going on. I know it's simplistic, but I wonder if you think it's got any merit at all, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Well, I absolutely agree with that. I mean, just even view what is an accelerator in itself. In other words, how is the energy applied to particles to accelerate them to higher velocity and then basically just break them into media and then look at their energy levels and spin of that little piece of mass, that little particle. And then it can be quantized and look at, what's actually happened to it. What's its mass, its spin, where did it start, where did it finish? But all of those, I think, are reality, there's so much to it, to break it down. But I think that you're right with that. There's so much going on at the molecular level, it's hard to put your finger on. And on top of that, it's, we need to go back and start looking at chemistry again, too, and seeing what's actually happening to the molecules, because there's other steps going on. In other words, when we think of things, we like to think of the simple, okay, it's just hydrogen or it's just oxygen. And then when you add energy to it, all of a sudden there's other chemical bonds taking place just within air itself. So it gets confusing, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
By the way, Glenn, do you know why when I use a gas of sulfur hexafluoride instead of air, that my breakdown voltage goes 2.5 times higher? You know what's going on there?
As of right now, Dick, no, but please let us know. KC2QIQ.
My best guess as to what's going on is that sulfur hexafluoride is a very stable compound. The sulfur and the fluorine molecules, I think it's a, I've got the name of it now, octahedron, tetrahedron molecule. Is it a tetrahedron? Yeah, I think it's a tetrahedron molecule. Extremely stable molecule. Those bonds between the sulfur and the fluorine are so tight that it takes a much higher velocity impact to create impact ionization to create the breakdown. Unfortunately, it's also a chlorofluorocarbon, so to speak, that affects the ozone. Wesley, go ahead. By the way, Wesley, I'm convinced that standing wave and stationary wave are the same thing. It's a matter of how you look at it. And a so-called standing wave is really two-wave same media. And it looks like a standing wave because you're non-differentially looking at your detector. If your detector was set up in such a way that it only looked at the forward-going wave, there would be no standing wave. If it only looked at the reverse-going wave, there would be no standing wave. When you combine the two into your detector, we detect something we call a standing wave. That's one way of looking at it to me, N2XAN, K2RIW.
N2XAN, out of shitty plan, look at that video that you saw. I imagine that you have a 3 miles long. It does have a component of standing wave. It does have a component of traveling wave. Now, imagine that a traveling wave that is forming and growing. And growing. It's a knife. Would you risk to put your finger over there? And again, when I put my Gauss meter, I'm able to sense the change over the magnetic field. One of the videos that I have sent you stated that at zeros, nodes, at nodes of standing wave, you have the maximums of magnetic field wave. And I use word wave. And that word is not shown in most of the videos. Now, when I'm measuring the changes of magnetic wave, I mean magnetic field, then I'm actually absorbing the energy. I'm disturbing or interacting with the standing wave. Now, stationary wave is not a standing wave. So I would appreciate if Glenn look at this 30 seconds video. He's got that. And I believe more light could come from John. John?
By the way, at those node points, it may look like there's nothing happening in E field, and yes, the H field is maximum at that point. I'm going to agree with that. But it only appears to be a node point with a non-directional detector. That node point has a lot of forward-going wave if you've got a directional detector looking at forward. It's got a lot of reverse-going wave if you've got a directional detector looking reverse.
Yeah, but you said last time that standing wave, there is no energy transfer, which is the standpoint of science on it. When I'm putting my Gauss meter on it and I'm able to detect the changes of the magnetic field, I'm doing the energy transfer. I'm interfering with that. I would appreciate if John take a standpoint.
I don't think I said that there is no energy transferring. I said that in the case of a standing wave, in a closed structure like a cavity resonator, there may not be energy leaving the enclosure, but there's a lot of energy bouncing back and forth. All right, John. And that's what a resonator is, energy bouncing back and forth and staying co-phase. You got it, John.
Okay, Dick, I'll try to describe the difference as we see it right now. The standing waves, as you said, there's two, one opposing the other. But the nodes are moving. The stationary wave travels in amplitude, but the nodes do not move.
Okay, if I've got a standing wave in my coax cable, and with my non-directional detecting technique, like a slotted line, with a simple probe going down the slotted line, I measure a particular spot in the slotted line where the voltage appears to go to zero. That doesn't mean that there's no energy there. There's lots of forward-going energy. There's lots of reverse-going energy. And as long as I don't change the length of the network, and as long as I don't change the frequency, that node does not move. It sits still. The location of that apparent node in my non-directional detector, I say it doesn't move. Back to you on that one, John.
Okay, because the directional coupler is actually mathematical at the the algebraic sum of that wave, but if you look at them independently, the nodes are moving. That's what I got out of that diagram that Wesley sent me.
And also another thing, John actually have made a discovery. If we can make